Hi, Kelvin.
Hi, Ada.
As a continuation of the previous talk, where we were talking about the P versus NP problem, we were looking at the immense prize that has been allotted to that, for which Tetriolis has an answer, but that same prize group, Clay Mathematics Institute, they also talked about the Navier-Stokes equation, which you have since looked at and come to realize that in Tetrionics, the fundamental problem described in the Navier-Stokes equation does not occur for the simple reason that in Tetrionics there is this strict differentiation between mass and matter. You've mentioned earlier that in looking at the Navier-Stokes problem from the perspective of Tetrionics, these are the two issues which immediately came to your mind. But first of all, again, you need to discern mass and matter. But as a result, also, there is clarity on the relationship between the linear and the nonlinear, which in a way comes back to the P versus NP story which we discussed before. And just before we recontinued this recording, I asked you to talk a bit more about that relationship between linear and nonlinear on the one hand, and on the difference between mass and matter on the other hand, with respect to the Navier-Stokes equation.
Right. This is going to be a heady one. It should be straightforward. I mean, like, if people just take, as I say, straightforward and follow the illustrations, we can hopefully get through it in a sensible sort of format. I suppose the biggest advantage with Tetrionics is that the geometry that's produced has a wealth of information, and it should, because it's describing physics. If it's to be believed, from the basis of the equilateral Planck quanta of electromagnetic energy and its associated square root linear momentum, these triangles give shape to all the physics and all the matter in our universe. So as different formations of energy come together via applied force or the insertion of energy, etc., obviously there's got to be a lot of fundamental information in the basic pattern that they form naturally. We measure these forces in various ways. Newton focused on linear momentum. Leibniz focused on scalar energy itself. Maxwell focused on transverse modulations or phase arrangements. Tesla focused on longitudinal. Everybody looks at it from a different perspective, even kinetic energy versus linear momentum. Both well-known terms, but both equally nebulous so far as the physics community goes, because there's no inherent picture as to what's giving us these slightly different formulations of energy. We, at its core, mathematics is about pattern recognition and then explaining those patterns, finding and explaining them in a regimented symbology, which gives us our mathematical notation as we see it, and our graphs and all the information that we know in how to differentiate between these different forms of energy or mass, energy, momenta. As we formulated and applied more and more math to looking at these patterns, what we've lacked is the geometry that gives rise to it all. Tetrionics, as I've mentioned a number of times before, starts with a priori postulate that Planck quanta are equilateral, and these equilateral quanta come together to form larger equilateral fields of energy momenta that are always squared. So even the word squared in physics is misleading. Likewise, you have linear and nonlinear systems. You have differential equations brought up from calculus, where we're We're taking time snapshots of a system evolving over time. We're trying to measure, we're trying to find the pattern of what's occurring to give us the end result, or what's happening in between, to give us a concrete physical understanding of the mechanics at work. And in doing so, as we've touched before, it's a bit like doing it blindfolded. You can use all your senses, your ears, your fingers, you can absorb all the information, but you have nothing visual to work on. Tetrionics gives us that visual approach, and in doing so, we end up with a picture where energy and momenta, as well as mass and even matter, are easily represented in a way that is done at a glance, and that way is geometrically, obviously, and then it's color-coded to enhance the geometric properties so that we can visually process the information using our eyes rather than mechanically manipulating symbols and notation in math to give us a set outcome. Now, if you do it with the math through the nonlinear differential equations, you have a string of symbols that you manipulate in set ways to give you a result. At no stage from when you first formulate the equation through the manipulation or the end result do you know what it is that you're manipulating or working on. You simply have a set of rules that takes a given value, performs a number of operations on it, and gives you an output. And that output is a value of a force or a measurement of weight or whatever it may be. But at still no time have you got any perception of what mass, matter, or even energy that you're working on in these calculations really looks like, or how it physically creates the results that we are formulating the math around. 8404 simply shows a basic geometry that had it been developed when Newton and Leibniz were doing their famous argument with each other over calculus, would have revealed a huge amount of information and probably changed calculus, differentiation, integration, all these sorts of things, and our understanding of physics forever. They both came at the same problem from different angles. And this is the important thing. In the case of Leibniz, he focused on energy, vis-a-vis, as I think he used to call it, or something like that. I probably butchered it. But the life force, what gives things life and motion. But what he was looking at was formulated as mv squared, which is the scalar energy of life, or the kinetic, well, not the kinetic energy as you would understand it, because you understand it as a half of this energy. But he saw it as mv squared, which is the scalar energy. Newton, on the other hand, looked at force and acceleration or changes of momentum over time. Again, it's all the same energy, but the momentum is simply, the linear momentum, I should stress, is the square root or the height of these equilateral fields of kinetic energy. And then again, further down the track, I won't say the name because I'll butcher it. Shocking with French. But there was another French scientist, a lady, well known. She then proved by dropping balls into clay that the kinetic energy was different yet again. It was a half mv squared. So we've got linear momentum, which is the square root of E. We have E as mv squared, and we have a half mv squared for kinetic energy. But at no stage have we got any real idea of what this energy is or how it really works, let alone what mass or matter is. As we developed further and further the mathematics, this ignorance, if you like, of what the geometry underlying it all was continued to fester. And it got to the point where, upon relativity being discovered without any geometry, a whole slew of problems became compounded, in that Einstein's solution with relativity was to treat mass and matter as being alternative forms of energy. So he related them through his equivalence of mass energy, E equals mc squared, to be energy, or a pressure gradient of energy in a region, and then develop special relativity without differentiating between them, because he's deliberately made them into an energy form without any physical geometry underlying them, just a gradient or a pressure in a cylinder, if you like. And then he developed general relativity on top of special relativity. So what happened was, we took a mathematical pattern and we've now expanded it and compounded its problems to the point where we now have fields of energy momenta, which we don't know what they look like, but we know they exist. They have energy, they have electric and magnetic components, they have linear momentum and scalar energy, and they're, to boot, they're all quantized under Planck's law. They're no longer a smooth continuous sheet. Somehow they're made up of chopped up components, all of which couldn't be unified. You could work on certain portions and explain things, just like Planck's law brought together the two Wien's heat law and the other heat law that was popular at the time, and resolved them by quantizing energy. We now have in Navier-Stokes a situation where we know these fields exist. We know that applying a force will put energy momenta into a system, that energy or mass along with momentum is conserved, but we're not sure how to do it. We're not sure how we can, what's the word I'm looking for? How we can mathematically describe these fields, both of matter and mass, energy, momentum, in an accurate way at any one instant. All we can describe is the particle themselves and their vector velocity or their motion, and the fact that any energy entered into the system is conserved, and that these particles interact with each other. It makes for a very confusing picture, especially when you look closely at Navier-Stokes equations and you realize that because of the way we perceive energy as being nebulous and not actually being there but having an effect with no way to describe it tangibly, what we have to do is we have to model or calculate the vector forces by solving three nonlinear differential equations for x, y, and z to give us the vector force that's being created. Now, if you know, like Tetrionics does, that the energy of motion is stored in a chem field, you know instantly that you can generalize that chem field, as we've done here, with an equilateral field, with the energy of the field being quantized, the square root being the linear momentum, which of course is related to the final velocity of the particle through the mass matter, or the mass of the material particle itself. So what we can now do is build these little models, and this is what I do in my head. If somebody says an electron is running around an electrical circuit, I simply picture the electron with its charge topology, and it's moving in one direction, so therefore it has a chem field pointing in that direction with the associated quantized energy momenta. Instantly on that chem field, I can draw as you see in 8404 in proportion to its velocity, the number of quanta in that field, its magnetic moment, the arrangement of the magnetic vector, which direction these dipoles are formed, how much force that particle can exert on other particles, how big the magnetic field around the conductor will be, and even down to the velocity of the electron in that copper wire. Now, if you wanted to take it to the next level, you could also model the charge topology of the copper atoms in the conductor that the electron is moving along, and then model the chem field as simply being the result of the electric field that's propagating through that copper molecules that in turn accelerate the electron. What I'm trying to show here is that tetrionics as a visual aid, once you understand it, can simply and quickly build a pictorial understanding of all the geometric forces in play in anything you want to model. So long as you know what how large the system, as in time frame, that the system is being measured in. If it's 1 second, it's the size of the orbit of the moon. If it's a microsecond, it's obviously smaller, down to bench top, nanoseconds. But whatever size area you're operating on, you then model all the atoms and their energy levels. You can then model the free electrons and the fact that when you pump a electric current through that conductor of copper, for example, the electric field, electrical energy, will flow through the copper, which will in turn cause the electrons to move. But the electrons will move slower than the electrical field. Electrical field will propagate at the speed of light, or sometimes faster, depending on how it's generated. But it provides a motivation, an EMF, electromotive force, to the electron to get it moving. As it moves, the energy in its chem field increases. You can picture all this visually, but if you try to solve it mathematically, along with the friction that's in the circuit, etc., the resistance, the equations will drive you mad. Not only just in their complexity, but the sheer number. Because you have to have Navier-Stokes equations for not just the particle and its motion, but also for the conductor, as it's a resistive medium to the flow of the electron. And this applies whether it's an electrical circuit or whether it's a wave on a beach or a wave of light moving through a vacuum and then going into a glass prism. They're all the same sort of equations. You can try and solve them using nonlinear equations that attempt, in a Cartesian sense, X, Y, and Z, to model the energy present as snapshots of this equilateral geometry, or you can simplify it right back down to what we have here in tetrionics. It may even be that what I've done here in tetrionics, there might even be more complexity, something that I've missed, where I've drawn electric and magnetic fields. Perhaps there's something else. I mean, like, I do draw the inertial component of, or the inertial mass of energy as a vector rotation. The vector rotation does not exist, but I can draw it as a illustrative vector rotation, the quantized angular momentum of the field itself. Whereas if you say quantized angular momentum in Navier-Stokes sense, you want to try and cancel that back out to zero if you're trying to solve them, because you want to move to a linear situation. You don't want to have any curl or any vector rotation at all. You want to try and keep the equations as simple as possible. So tetrionics can leave a lot more information in. Accordingly, you can move it back out. If you just wanted to concern yourself with a simpler solution, which way the particle is moving, ignore all the information in the triangle except for the square root, because that's the linear momentum That gives you your vector direction, your magnitude of the velocity, gives you all the information you need, which is exactly what you're doing when you get rid of, when you strip down a Navier's, when you go for the Stokes solution and just try and keep it as simple as possible in order to solve it. But accordingly, in the same snapshot, if you suddenly look at, you want to know what the information is of how many quanta was in that field, you can do that with tetrionic geometry. The information's always there. It's easy to visualize, and you can rewrite the geometry mathematically, either as a trig explanation, a trig function, or as a nonlinear differential equation measuring the electric and magnetic, or the energy momenta, or the mass momenta, mass velocity, whichever aspects you care to focus on. All that information is inherent in tetrionic geometry, which isn't in, you have to choose one or the other, what you're solving for mathematically. And as I said, even once you've solved it, you're still at a loss as to exactly what it is that you've solved. You know it's a value, but there's nothing tangible, no physical geometry behind it to explain what's doing, other than that the particles are moving in one direction or another. And of course, people will always bring in Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, that the position and the momentum can't be known at the same time in quantum mechanics, so it's impossible to solve these simultaneous nonlinear differential equations, when in fact tetrionics shows you exactly the opposite, that Heisenberg's uncertainty principle does not play a role in quantum mechanics. It's purely a consequence of the statistical distribution of Planck quanta in a chem field and our ignorance of what that geometry is that caused the Heisenberg uncertainty principle to be born. And since its birth, it's been used as a crutch by people who don't know the answer and don't want to explain that they don't know the answer. So they simply say it's impossible to know both the position and the momentum of a particle at any one time. You can know one or the other, but you can't solve for both. Well, quite clearly, in tetrionics, you can know both, you do know both, and they're all solvable, and they're all predictable. So all those aspects go aside. Now, the other side issue that comes up, which always has me laughing and scratching my head, is the question of mass matter in physical systems. Just like Heisenberg's uncertainty principle with position momentum, physics these days does not differentiate, doesn't define, firstly, in any meaningful sense, I'll justify that, and it doesn't differentiate between mass and matter. Now, the definitions have been around for centuries, but it's become so confused in physics now that you'll see scientific papers where in the same sentence people will mix the word mass and matter and interchange them without any regard to the difference between the two physical properties. Mass, as per Einstein's mass energy equivalence, is a measure of energy per second. As in, I'm just trying to find a picture as I talk here. E equals mc squared can be rearranged algebraically to be m for mass, lowercase m, equals E per c squared. Now, we show in tetrionics that c squared is just a spatial measurement, or the inverse of c squared. Sorry, c squared is a spatial measurement of time for 1 second. It's a radial measurement of how far energy can map out a region of space per second based on the speed of light. So in 1 second, light can map out a radial area of c squared. The impedance of that region of space depends what's in it. In the case of vacuum energies, etc., it's 1 over c squared. The impedance of free space, as I term it, in a 1 second region, is the inverse of c squared. So energy in a 1 second region of space is E divided by c squared, which is mass. It's not matter. You should never say matter is converted to energy under Einstein's equation of E equals mc squared, because that's not the case. Matter, sorry, back to mass. Mass is a 2D Euclidean form of radiant energy. It can be a charge, it can be a photon. It's a, the best description in standard physics would be that it is a boson or a photon, or a immaterial field, an EM field of energy with associated momenta or mass, and or mass, I should say. It is a, simply, the analogy I would tend to use based on my templates is that it is a sheet of paper. It has a Euclidean geometry, just a flat sheet. There is no, there is an X and Y component to the geometry, but there is no Z component. There's no height. When it comes to matter, there is a height. The first form of matter that can be formed from radiant mass energy is a tetrahedron. It's four Planck quanta, and they form in such a way as to create a closed volume. And that's important. It's a 3D closed volume. The energy, the mass energy, I should say, in that 3D tetrahedron always propagates at the speed of light. So that the mass content of the matter topology has an energy content of E equals mc squared. So if you collapse matter, you release mass energy. Now, this is where some people are going to get a real headache as I describe this next few steps. Having said that there's a distinct difference between mass and matter, we'll now delve right into that distinct difference, and it becomes very important when you're looking at things like quantum cosmology and how you you need to differentiate between mass energy geometries, planar sheets of energy, and matter topologies in physics, because if you don't, you will never understand how gravitational fields work. And the nonlinear instantaneous equations of general relativity are exactly the same problem as what Navier-Stokes experience in just general wave equations, things like that. They're identical. They're all based around the same problem, a lack of understanding of how the mass energy is arranged and what differentiates it from matter. So in 70.09, I'll try and go through this in a nice sensible fashion, we're about to differentiate between mass and matter. In this case, we're talking general relativity, but the information applies either way. An equilateral Planck quanta with no time component, no differentiation, no delta T, is simply energy, E, the big red E, as you'll see in tetrionics. It's in the center of the bottom of the page. It's the building block of everything. Once we start measuring in time, or increments of time, we can start to differentiate energy from mass and matter, and from 2D radiant geometries, from 3D standing wave topologies. And that's the difference between mass and matter. You'll see in tetrionics that When it comes to mass and matter, unfortunately, they both have the same M for the beginning of their name. So to help differentiate, where I refer to mass, I always use a lowercase m, because it's two-dimensional. It's the lower dimensionality. Capital M's for matter, where it's a topology, a higher order, three dimensions. There's no more than three dimensions. Even the fourth dimension of time, as it's often referred, is actually contained within the two dimensions of mass energy. But we'll cross that in another discussion. So we have energy, which is just purely a triangle of electromagnetic fields. Once we measure that per second, which is C squared, we have exactly the same field. Nothing has changed, but it is now called mass or energy per second, as Newton would have termed it had he known. In Newton's equations, you'll often see in acceleration particularly, seconds squared. Everyone gives you anything ranging from a shrug of the shoulders to a wild explanation as to what seconds squared are. Tetrionics shows that seconds squared is simply C squared squared. So 1 second equals C squared. Second squared is C to the fourth. Or instead of a radial spatial coordinate, you now have a spherical spatial coordinate, where a circle by a circle creates a sphere geometrically. That sphere is required in order to measure the Z component of any matter topology, because a matter topology has a Z component. That it's a topology versus a non-Z or an XY component geometry for mass energy. So on 70.09, what we're simply showing you there is that rho per square meter, or energy density per square meter, is mass. Energy per second is mass. Energy per second squared can either be mass, or more appropriately, it can be a measure of matter. Tetrahedra are made up of, have four sides, which of course have mass energy in them. The four sides are flat sheets of energy. So when you talk matter, you're also talking mass energy matter, which you'll see cropping up in my work. It'll be MEM. But the important takeaway is that energy has three forms. It has its pure energy form, which has no time component, no differentiation. But differentiated per second, you have a measurement of mass. Per second squared, you have a mass matter, or just matter. And you can see there that tetrionics, in its unified field equation, always puts n pi for the geometries of mass energy, and tau pi, or t pi, capital T, for matter topologies. But simply seeing C squared or C to the fourth usually indicates whether you're talking mass or mass matter. Now, from there, as simple to me as that was, the real icing on the cake is in 70.10, where once you realize that mass, energy, and matter are all forms of energy, but with different differentiation because of the time component, you can suddenly see a relationship evolve that wasn't apparent, or was apparent, but was never, for some reason, approached by the mathematicians. And that's mainly that mass is related to matter. Because, as I said, a tetrahedral matter quanta, a tetrion, has four sides of mass energy that are constantly circulating at the speed of light. So if you work through the equations, you obviously have Einstein's equation of mass energy equivalence, or mass or energy, sorry, mass is energy per second when you rearrange it algebraically. But we also know now that matter is energy per second squared, or c to the fourth. They're both m, so if you were to use the same case m, you'd end up very confused as to what this is telling you. And I've done this with mathematicians. I've said quite simply this: everybody's aware of Einstein's mass energy equation, E equals mc squared. All serious mathematicians know how to algebraically rearrange that to give us mass equals E divided by C squared. If M by C squared equals E, what does M divided by C squared equal? And that drives the mathematicians nuts. You would not believe the different answers I get. There's only three components in that question, and it's a simple question. MC squared equals E. M divided by C squared is what? The answer is, as you see there, it's matter in the strictest sense. M divided by C squared is simply E divided by C to the fourth. This is how tetrionics differentiates mathematically and geometrically between mass and matter in physics and energy, because energy is just E. So the way, what's not written there is, what you've got is E equals MC squared. It can also be capital MC to the fourth, which is an unknown equation, but it's just as valid as Einstein's mass energy equivalence. What's confusing the entire situation is firstly the word mass and matter both starting with M, and the lack of understanding of this topology versus geometry in physics, and how to understand energy and mass and matter as energy differentiated in different times, seconds or second squared or C squared or C to the fourth. Only the geometry reveals this, because if you try to do that manipulation, as I said, what is M divided by C squared equal? The mathematicians can't make sense of it. It's a very simple equation to solve, but because mass and matter weren't properly defined and have no physical geometry or topology as they do in tetrionics, you can't get a sensible answer out of the math. But this is at the core of where relativity is struggling, why they can't make sense of certain equations, and why things like Navier-Stokes and even Euler's formula becomes so difficult, because you have to rely entirely on the math. You have no geometric basis with which to visualize it. You have no grammar from the geometry in which to correct incorrect assumptions in mathematics. So you end up with a whole slew of answers, and you have no way of knowing whether it's an appropriate answer or not. Once you have the geometry, you know what's appropriate, and more importantly, you can visualize what can be done and what these terms in mathematics really are. You know that if you see a tetrahedron, it's matter. You know that if you see a equilateral triangle, that it's a boson. It's a form of mass. And here's the final kicker. For as long as Einstein's E equals mc squared has existed, there's been a debate raging over photons. which are now classically called, or not even classically, but are now just termed massless particles. They are not massless particles. They have energy, energy per second or per unit of time differentiated is mass. So it's completely incorrect to call photons massless particles. You're left with only two other names that you can call them, and that is because they're geometries of energy, mass, energy, momenta, you can call them matterless, and that's what the illustration I've just given you now is. They are matterless photons, or more appropriately, they're weightless. They're not affected by gravity. They're not bent by gravity, as Einstein claims. Gravity plays no role in their mechanics. Gravitation does, but gravity has no effect on EM photons or EM waves. Yet another misunderstanding in current physics that just clouds the problem, because when they try to do nonlinear or differential or vector field analysis of gravitational fields, they don't know what it is that's acting on the particles, and they don't know the mechanics of what's going on. We've discussed it before. Tetrionics shows that universal gravitation is the result of three vector forces: convergent gravity created by matter topologies, and interactive, that is convergent and divergent, vector forces created by EM fields. The bending of starlight around stars by Einstein's nonlinear field equations is the result of EM wave refraction, not the bending of the path of photons by gravity. And this is where tetrionics shines, because it gives us geometric solutions that explains this, while at the same time explaining why there's a similarity between Newton's formula for gravity and Coulomb's electric charge formula, and at the same time why, when Einstein described everything as a stress energy tensor, that is, didn't differentiate between mass and matter, why he formulated this curvature of space-time. All these, the reason why we can't unify Einstein's field equations with quantum mechanics is because we can't solve for what gravity looks like, or even if it's quantized. There's no explanation for it. But when you view matter as a positive displacement topology that in turn creates an electromagnetic field around itself, suddenly, electromagnetic field of mass energy around it, suddenly you can see visually these vector forces that are created by the topology and by the radiant mass energy geometries. And not only visualize the fields, but how do I say this? You have the ability to either focus on the linear vector forces, or you can look at the scalar or the quantized energy momenta that's at play in each and every one of these fields, which is how tetrionics becomes the unified theory of everything, because we describe not only mass, energy, momenta, but matter and how it affects each other in any spatial field. And that's what Navier-Stokes is aiming to do through its nonlinear differential equations. It's trying to take a three-dimensional region of space model all the particle motions and the fields of force, the Brownian motion, the friction, the actual physical particle motion, and produce an end result that matches the physical model of the same thing. You try and do that mathematically and you're confronted with thousands of non-linear, forever changing, constantly interacting fields of force, as well as physical particles. And it's just too intense for the mathematics to handle. But the geometry, on the other hand, can easily accommodate that. And more excitingly, once you understand the geometry, you can solve a lot of these things in your head. Not to the same degree as physically calculating the exact answer, but you can model an electron in motion in a conductor, or a series of water molecules in motion through, or blood molecules through a vein. You can model these things quickly in your head and get an intuitive understanding of the interactions that are taking place. And as I said at the beginning, all that remains then is for us to sit down, transcribe these geometries into a more precise mathematical format or terminology that we can input into a supercomputer, and the supercomputer can model any scale or any size system that we want for the duration that we want it to model it. We just have to allow it the time to do the calculations. But you can clearly see, in a geometric sense, that a 3D solution to the Navier-Stokes problem is easily done geometrically. It's only difficult mathematically, just as it was with P versus NP. Mathematically, very hard to solve. Geometrically, reasonably simple to explain and to solve. But the approach isn't what they expected, because the mathematics was lacking geometric information in its formulation. And I'll probably stop it there.
That's wonderful, Calvin. There's a lot of stuff that you bring together again. On my understanding, I see things repeat and as a result fall in place. It's like I start to see the balls that the juggler is handling. I'm no longer baffled by this ongoing waterfall of motion, but I actually see what principle it is composed of, and also that for the Navier-Stokes equation description, and let me pull that back, for the Navier-Stokes equation prize, it does require a different form of thinking, but in the same way as you have already done that for the P versus NP story, which is also how we came into the Navier-Stokes story, you're able to explain how it works, you're able to show how it works, plus others can then follow that by the understanding of tetrionics and a specifically different approach that it takes to regarding the problem, essentially the mathematics can be replaced by the geometry. And one of the important points in what you described was that in mathematics, the mathematician is working with numbers, but in the numbers which have values, you cannot see what dimensions they represent, because they are a number. So in that sense, you're dealing with quantities without qualities, which, by the way, is also the difficulty in economics, where money is a quantity without a quality. But so in tetrionics, you see that you must know what dimensions you are working with. You must see if you're dealing with a tetrahedron, which is material, or if you are dealing with a triangle, which is immaterial, which is energy. In the Navier-Stokes equation, you've now basically given the foundation for the need to put apart the description of the particles and the description of the forces, and you've not been very explicit on the way you work with that. So let me just imagine how I would conceive that. In the Navier-Stokes equations, wherever there is a reference to particles, that would be by necessity displayed by tetrahedra or complexes of tetrahedra in tetrionics.
Yep.
And where the Navier-Stokes equation refers to the forces, by necessity in tetrionic theory, that would be modeled as triangles. So immediately
as the energy momentum.
Yes. So immediately you are modeling two different strata of perception. You're setting the particles aside as essentially invariant unities, which are then looked at in relationship to each other in triangular fields, which represent the forces.
Or the energy momentum created by the forces.
Yes. And I'd like to go back in my mind for a moment, because when I was in engineering school looking at the fluid dynamics of the relationship between particles and forces, evidently I was running into, I was running head on into these problems that you now described. In mathematics, in the numbers, you cannot see the dimensions and you cannot see the difference between particles and forces, because all of them are represented by variables, and all of them are ultimately brought back to numbers. I had to get out of the trap by studying dimensional analysis and system theory. In system theory, there is a very explicit difference between states and processes and interactions and phase changes. There's four levels of the description. And in dimensional theory, you actually see the same in terms of space, time, energy, and phase. So, in that approach, I already saw that you need to change all of the description from mathematics into descriptions of system theory, for the simple reason that you must discern between an object, a process, an interaction, or a creation.
And between the material and immaterial.
Exactly. And at the same time, you also need to know the difference between space, time, energy, and consciousness, or phase space.
Oh, yeah.
For me, that was a reason why I went into medicine, to see in the body how that interaction of information and matter actually takes place. And that led me to the discovery that you can actually see that in detail at the moment of cell division, which is also the level where you then can see how we operate freedom of choice. But at that level, I was just looking back at the discussion which we are exploring now, of the Navier-Stokes equation, because it is also one of the equations which is used for describing the interaction of the river and the bedding. In fact, my focus in my engineering studies was on the interplay between the river and the bedding, which I generalized in looking at the relationship between the ocean and the coast. But I ran into a difficulty in description, because I actually needed to try to find a way to resolve that by using discrete computational techniques to address a harmonic cyclic description model. And so at that time, tetrionics was not available, so I couldn't do much more than say that, that is a complex thing of calculation, and okay, you can use some network computations, but in the network computations you have some difficulties with the models. Now coming back to the essence of it, what I was doing at the level of network or cellular computations, basically you calculate a very little cell, and in that model it was still a square, you would immediately start to laugh, because you would say now, had you just used a triangle, you would have been so much better off. But so
easy with hindsight.
yeah. So I fully appreciate that what I was trying to calculate in terms of squares, using inputs and outputs, or basically the relationship between a particle represented by the square and the inputs and the outputs of the square representing the forces. So at that level, I essentially got really close to discovering tetrionics, but I didn't. You did. Okay. So I'm really enjoying that you did, and that as a result, you now also see that what I was looking at the interplay of the river and the bedding, or the ocean and the coast, of the wave and the breaking of the wave, and the discrete computation and the analogous models of physics, that now can be resolved by the tetrionic solution for the Navier-Stokes equation, in which the Navier-Stokes equation...
You can also...
Yeah.
You can just sorry to butt in, but you can also see in that last illustration I sent you, 90.02.
Yeah.
The one thing I keep forgetting to mention is that mathematics, when you see squared numbers, immediately go to matrices, squared matrices, 3x3, 4x4, etc. Whereas those same squared numbers form a natural vector, just like the bow of a boat. A vector wake, if you like, in the equilateral geometry. So they're more, they lend themselves by their geometric nature more to fluid dynamics and to vector forces, things like that you're trying to describe, which have this linear forward motion in all the cases. And that's what you're trying to model, the friction of the coastline against the actions of the wave and the energy they contain. Things like that, you're trying to model that, but if you try and do that with a traditional matrices, which are square shapes, you've got no information in it except the numbers that you get out at the end, like we said. But if you look at that illustration there, you can see how you can even modify those squared, in quotation, matrices to actually reflect the electric and the magnetic forces. It just means retraining your brain to draw squared matrices in triangular form. But that's an inherent part of the geometry. And as you said, I mean, like, had you thought to draw it that way, or had you made the same connections I did early in the piece, it often amazes me why nobody's discovered tetrionics before. As I've mentioned to you a couple of times, sometimes I sit back and go, how was this missed? That there's any number of clues that could have brought people to the same conclusion. It's
for
some reason, didn't click.
Yeah, I can easily explain that. And it was why I wrote a paper entitled The Paradigm Shift. Actually, the title of the paper is Shifting the Paradigm. Because I'm not interested in a paradigm, I'm not interested in a paradigm shift. I'm interested in what is the process behind it, and how can you turn it on? And at the time that I was working on those calculations, the mathematics was based on squares, the model was based on squares, the computers were based on squares. And so essentially, it's like the pieces of the puzzle were all geared toward being put on a table instead of being draped around a ball. If you make a puzzle of the earth, you see that they actually are made to fit the table and not the earth. And in the same way, the mathematical and sociological, psychological maps of the earth and of humanity are made to map the table, to fit on the table and not on the planet. which is where all these problems in ecology and economy and sociology and health stem from. So once you start with a model and pursue with the model, you cannot get out of it, because whatever new tool you take will in a way guide you back to the old model, which didn't work. So if you actually want to shift the understanding in science, you need to go back to the basics, and you did that perfectly well by going the only basis that science has found, which was the Planck jump. And instead of talking about the quantum leap or the quantum shift or the quantum distance, you put that into a shape, as a result of which the empty space, which was outside of the scope of physics, basically they ran into, okay, the smaller than that we cannot get, and the only thing we know that there is the quantum leap. And you just gave that space on Earth by putting it in a triangle, and as a result you were able to solve also the equation of Navier-Stokes. But you can also show that you can only compute that if you actually use a computer which is based on tetrionic logic. So you need to have a three-phase computer, actually a four-phase computer, because the inversion is the dynamic which needs to be explicitly included. And then when you have that four-phase computer, then you actually are doing exactly the same as what I started to write in my first paper of the Human Limits to Man-Made Model, that if you want to change the boundary of the system, you must turn the boundary inside out, but you cannot do that except as a dynamic. So it's not that you go from, say, the one side of the equation to the other side of the equation, and whatever was plus on the one side becomes a minus on the other, but you actually need to realize that the zero point is the equation sign where we are actually operating the mathematics. And I wrote a paper on that called Mathemagics, which was about our role in shifting the boundaries of our understanding. And that's also what is at the core of the discussion which we had previous time about the P versus NP, of which we now see the other side in the Navier-Stokes equation, because that is explicitly the equation in which you try to determine the relationship between the river and the bedding, or between consciousness and matter. So when we were discussing the P versus NP, we looked at the prize which was available for that, and which you already have said that you now have the solution for. The only thing now required now is to put that solution in print and wait 2 years. But that same prize also applied to the Navier-Stokes equation again. Put the solution in print and wait 2 years, and then people can see that both the P versus NP problem and the Navier-Stokes problem can be solved by tetrionics, albeit that for reasons that you have explained today, you cannot do that in mathematics, because mathematics turns operations into calculations in which the quality of the quantities are not seen, and the dimensions of the operations are ignored. In tetrionics, you work with the geometry, so the dimensions are explicit, and the qualities are explicit, because qualities are relationships between elements, which is why a picture is worth a thousand words. And
absolutely, you won't see it without the picture.
So in my mind, it would be practical to round off this conversation and this recording, because at this point I do not think that we can go much more further into the detail of how the Navier-Stokes equation can be modeled in tetrionics. But on the other hand, it does seem to come down to the counterpart of what you've done last week, where the first publication of tetrionics went into the journal in India, with a likely follow-up now of a publication for the tetrionic perspective on the P versus NP problem and the tetrionic formulation for the Navier-Stokes equation. But what you mentioned already last time when we're talking about this prize for the P versus NP problem and the tetrionic P and NP solution, there already you said that there is this direct agreement with the Navier-Stokes equation, which you have since looked at. So in my mind, I would not be surprised if by now you have found further agreement for what you intuited last time, that you said that the P versus NP story and the Navier-Stokes story are actually very closely related.
And they certainly maybe, are.
Maybe it would be even simpler to have one paper in which you can claim both prizes.
The trick will be getting mathematicians to see the logic in the explanation. Explaining
well, I would rather
succinctly.
Ignore that part of it. I would rather go simply into how in tetrionics can you show that the P versus NP situation is not a problem, but actually a solution for hyper-compact information encoding. And that in the same way, the Navier-Stokes equation actually very strongly indicate that's not the relationship between the river and the bedding, but that it's the interplay between the forces and matter. And once you pull that apart, as you do in tetrionics, then you in fact already have the solution, because the problem already came out of the confusion between energy and matter. So if it's okay with you, I'd love to explore that for how could that be put into a paper which you can then probably publish in the same journal as a sequel, in which you say, okay, by the way, if you use tetrionics and if you see that it's not about getting confused when you have linear and non-linear equations, but you simply see that the non-linear equations are higher harmonics of the underlying pattern, and if you on the other hand realize that matter and mass are distinct, then you can see that already have a solution for Navier-Stokes problem. And by the way, if you want to learn more than to this website, tetrionics.
So I would suggest that we end this recording for now. But as always, I'd like to give you the last word on putting the thing in the face of whatever way you choose.
Thanks, Otto. I mean, like, for sure, what we've covered here is a pretty high-level topic, as was P versus NP and Euler's formula. It might be worthwhile if the next discussion we have is actually on material versus immaterial, or matter versus mass energy, so far as their interactions, which I think would probably help round off the discussion between P versus NP as a information field of force, energy force, energy momenta, versus the Navier-Stokes problem, where we're looking at the interplay between matter and mass energy. So if the next discussion we have is a discussion on how tetrionics explains Newton's three laws, Coulomb's law, and fields of force between matter, which is probably a very important discussion, because it really sums up physics, because physics as it's developed is the study of material particles, where we've ignored the immaterial through a relationship that Descartes struck with the church, And as a consequence, as Tesla said, the day that we start studying the immaterial, i.e. forces, electrical or otherwise, there's a lot to be discovered. We'll probably learn more in that period than ever before, and I've certainly learned a lot. So I think it'd make a valuable part three, if you like, to this discussion, where I can, now that we've explained the difference between mass, energy and matter, we do an exploration of exactly how these forces between particles comes about, and the difference between, because of the difference between mass and matter, which I just, in my opinion, would probably tie it together in my mind, if nothing else, but I think it'd be good for the other people following the discussion.
Wonderful. Yes, let's do that. So let me end the recording for now, and then as usual I come back to you so that we can see what we can do next. Thank you, Kelvin. Mm-hmm.